Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party candidate for president and the Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and organize and agitate for the eco-socialist program that Angela Walker and I ran on. So I think first thing I want to do is remember Daniel Ellsberg, who passed away yesterday. I had the privilege of talking to him for about 5 hours during the 2020 campaign, two of them on a podcast where we debated whether progressives should vote for me or for Biden. And he was very friendly and almost gushing about talking to a presidential candidate. Apparently, no presidential candidate had ever asked him for his opinion. And we talked about a lot of things. Especially nuclear disarmament strategies, which was an issue I tried to raise. But we didn't agree on who to vote for. I didn't persuade him. He stuck with Biden out of fear of Trump's threat to democracy. And I didn't agree that's the best way to fight neo-fascism in this country. It was about more than Trump. It's about a movement that we've had, basically white supremacist reaction. And it's still there. That is what motivates that MAGA base. And I don't think the neoliberal politics of the Democratic Party and the accommodation that Biden does, he's still calling for bipartisanship with the party to try to overthrow him. So we didn't agree on that, but, I don't hold that against him. I really respect what he did, you know, releasing the Pentagon Papers, facing life imprisonment, contributed a lot to ending U.S. Involvement in that war. And so I think he'll always be remembered for that. What I would suggest, the way for us to remember and honor him, is to read his second Pentagon Papers, which were in his book in 2018, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, which Ellsberg was with the RAND Corporation. And he lost a lot of the documents. He had pilfered documents related to nuclear war planning as well as the Vietnam War. And that was, he was hoping it would be a second Pentagon paper, but they got lost in a flood where he had stashed them outdoors. You can read about that in the book. But what if you read that book, you will find documented how close we are and have been many times to nuclear war. And he, you know, relies and relates his experience as a nuclear war planner. And the basic idea of the doomsday machine, if one nuke goes, they all go. It's automated, limited or tactical nuclear war is a fantasy. And both the US and Russia have this, what they call a dead hand policy. So even if the leadership is wiped out, that dead hand is on a button and it'll go off. And massive retaliation, even if the leaders are dead from a first strike by the other side. So I would say, you know, if you want to honor Daniel Ellsberg, take the time to read that book and then get active campaigning for his nuclear disarmament proposals. For example, let's get rid of the ICBMs. They don't add to our deterrence. They just are targets right here in the continental United States. And to take them off the table would be a nuclear disarmament initiative that would signal to the other nuclear powers that we are getting serious about nuclear disarmament, in contrast to what we've done for the last two decades and get out of the Anti-Ballistic Missiles Treaty and the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, the Open Skies Treaty, and of course, you know, the belligerents. And, you know, we have used nuclear weapons the same way Putin's been using them, the same way, and Daniel Ellsberg often used this analogy, the same way an armed robber puts a gun to your head and says, give me all your money. He didn't have to shoot the gun. He just has to threaten. That nuclear bullying, the U.S. has done many times. Every time we've said, like with respect to Iran, that all options are on the table. Iran hears nuclear weapons are on the table too. And of course, Putin has done that. And not just Putin, Medvedev, a whole lot of leaders in Russia have done that in this war in Ukraine. You know, it's a shame. I tried to raise it in 2020, but I was pretty much blanked out from the media. Biden and Trump didn't talk about nuclear disarmament. It was never raised by the media in their debates. And that's what Daniel Ellsberg went to his grave worrying about. And I would suggest the best way to remember and honor him is to worry about it and do something about it. So other news this week was, I think it was on Thursday, the Supreme Court, by a 7-2 vote, called Hallin versus Brackeen, upheld the 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act, which people have asked me to talk about on this podcast. And what the law does is allow states to give American Indian families preference in the adoption of indigenous children. And this was adopted in 1978. We knew in the 70s that a quarter to a third of all Native American children were being taken from their families and raised by non-Indigenous families. So that law corrected that, and those numbers have got much better. The grounds for the decision were that the challengers to the law did not have standing because it is the states, not the federal government, that administers this law, which means the challenge on race discrimination grounds, which is what they brought it on, is not resolved. And so the plaintiffs are taking their case to state court. They had one in district court and then got a mixed decision in the New Orleans-based Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the plaintiffs were the state of Texas, and they did it on behalf of an evangelical Christian family. And it was backed by conservative legal groups that tout the free market, small government policies, including the Goldwater Institute and the Cato Institute. And what those institutes are really interested in is not so much the adoption of indigenous children, but undermining the sovereignty of indigenous nations and opening them up and their resources for exploitation by big business, big corporations. So if the law is eventually ruled unconstitutional, going through the state courts, it will undermine the sovereignty of Indian nations. So we got a good decision, but the issue's not over yet. And so I guess it's good to get some good news, but let's not rest on our laurels. And I just got back from 2 weeks in South Korea. I attended the Global Greens Congress there in Incheon, which is near Seoul, South Korea. And I have to say, the sessions I attended where people talked about issues were underwhelming. You know, I just really didn't get much out of them. There are a few good speeches. I appreciated the speech of the German leader of the Green Party, Reinhard Bütikofer, on why we need to support Ukraine in its struggle for independence and self-determination. I got to make a presentation in a workshop on democracy where I talked about citizen assemblies as being the foundation, the institutional foundation for what the Green Party calls grassroots democracy. It's really never been elaborated. And so I went through the history of assemblies of the citizens from the French Revolution through many revolutionary periods, and noted that ironically, a theorist who really pushed this idea was Murray Bookchin. And I worked with him in the 80s, and we were talking about implementing this in the United States, sort of expanding upon the town meeting tradition in New England and running green candidates who would advocate rewriting city charters so that we establish neighborhood assemblies or town assemblies in the smaller towns, open to all citizens, that were the foundation of democracy. And then people we put on coordinating bodies, legislative bodies, councils, would be delegates of those assemblies who would receive instructions from them on how to deal with issues and could be recalled at any time, and how that was what the Paris Commune set up in 1871 for its brief life. And it, for a brief period, it brought together both the anarchist and Marxist wings of the socialist movement, because they said that is the form of political democracy that is the socialist future. And so, you know, I advocated that the Greens need to really put that in the center of our democracy program. You know, we're good about fair elections, proportional representation, ranked choice voting, public campaign financing, fair ballot access, all those good things. But if we're talking about a grassroots democracy where power really comes from the bottom up, we've got to talk about citizen assemblies and how they are the foundation and they coordinate through mandated and recallable delegates. My talk was well received, and we got a little network of people that are going to work on filling out the democracy agenda for Greens globally. I didn't really connect with the South Korean Greens. Part of that, when I did talk to some of them, was just translation problems. But I was invited, or the Greens who were there at the time were invited before the Congress to a meeting with the Justice Party, which is a left-wing party in South Korea, which has 6 members of their National Assembly, which is like our Congress. And we had a news conference inside the National Assembly building. It's like having a news conference inside Congress. And, you know, we talked about the things we shared. One of them was proportional representation. The Justice Party has 2% of the 300 representatives in the National Assembly, but they got 10% of the vote. And that's because their proportional representation only covers a portion of the people elected to their Congress. The rest are elected from single member districts by plurality wins. And so I said in my little talk, which you can see on my website, howiehawkins.us, that limited proportional representation is limited democracy. And Korea is a little bit ahead of us, but the United States has a much longer way to go. And then we made a statement against the dumping of radioactive wastewater from the Fukushima nuclear power plants. TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, is saying they're running out of storage space, and therefore they have to dump this radioactive water into the ocean. And I'll tell you, people across East Asia are really upset about that. We made a statement with the Justice Party, and then when I was at the Congress, people from the Progressive Party asked to meet with me. They were observing, and we had a good long discussion, and they invited me to a demonstration that the Fishermen's Union was putting on. And so that was Monday after the Congress. I went to that, and I'm really glad I did. We don't do demonstrations like they do in South Korea. Fishermen's Union, you know, we go to demonstrations, we're milling around, talking to each other, listening to the stage. It's not real focused. The Fishermen's Union, they had a street in front of the National Assembly, and they're all sitting cross-legged on the street in nice rows. They all had signs, and they were paying attention to the stage. And they were doing things like, you know, they do a wave. They had 4,000 fishermen there. And they do a wave, and they throw their signs up, and you go to the back, and then they come back to the front, kind of like we do in football games going around the stadium. They had a fisherman's anthem and a dance that people could do sitting on their bottoms because it was, you know, I can't do it, but they, you know, make all these hand gestures and synchronization. And it just showed the unity and their spirit. And it was nice to see that when they let the political party representatives speak, the Justice Party and the Progressive Party spoke together. You know, the two representatives were up on the stage. The Progressive Party has 1 representative in the National Assembly. So it was good to see the Justice Party people again and to go over there with the Progressive Party people. So what else to tell you? That was the highlight really for me. My participation, I got in about 6 news stories in South Korea, being there, speaking out for Fukushima. And it's ironic because here in New York, we've been fighting dumping of that same radioactive water that is left over from the Indian Point nuclear power plants, which are being decommissioned. And Holtec International, which is doing the decommissioning, wants to dump that water in the Hudson River. And we've been opposing it. And while I was in South Korea, the state Senate unanimously passed a law to make that illegal, but it didn't come to the floor of the assembly because the Democratic leadership, at the behest of the governor, wouldn't let it come. So that's your damn Democrats for you. They fronted for the nuclear, decommissioning company, Holtec. So we're still fighting that here, like they're fighting that there. And one of the things that came out in that demonstration was they got a statement of solidarity from the fishermen around Fukushima. And what they said was, we're connected by the ocean and through the ocean to everybody in the world. And I thought that was a nice metaphor for the solidarity. So I got one more article that I'll put on the website about, my anti-nuclear activity while I was in South Korea. And a lot of pictures of the Justice and Progressive Party people that I'm with and of the demonstration. So I hope to get that up in a day or two. So that's the news. Although I think you're going to talk about Cornel West and some other things. So I'm ready for your questions and comments. How did I guess that? Thoughts on Cornel West seeking the Green Party nomination. You know, I talked with Angela Walker earlier today to see what she thought. And she had the same reaction that I did. You know, what the, this guy, when we talked to him, he was supporting Biden in 2020. And he had this, I think, shallow analysis that if Biden can defeat Trump, fascism is defeated, and then we can go after the Democrats' neoliberalism. And Angela and I told him, hey, this Trump is a symptom of a right-wing trend in American politics, white supremacist racism and intolerance and bigotry that has been, central to politics, the Dixiecratic South and segregation and slavery, all that. And it's still manifesting itself. So it's more than Trump. It can't just be overcome in one election. When you elect a milquetoast neoliberal, as Cornel West rightly calls Joe Biden, and then what Cornel's saying now is neoliberalism is the way I put it is they're sowing the seeds of fascism by not taking care of the needs of the people, the material needs of the people in particular. So that was my first reaction. What the fuck? And then my second reaction is, he announced with the People's Party, which is an online grift, top-down, authoritarian, no membership. I mean, and they just announced he's their candidate. Do they have a membership? Did they have any say in it? Apparently not. And, they certainly don't have the capacity to get on the ballots in 50 states in the District of Columbia. So I thought that was poor judgment on Cornel West's part. He just, they asked him, I guess, and he said yes. And this isn't the first time he's had poor judgment. He was a advocate, he did a lot of campaign work for Barack Obama in 2008, who, he was a corporate neoliberal from way back. And when Obama didn't include West in his inner circles and White House events, Cornel was upset. And then he became a critic of that neoliberal policy, but he could have seen that coming. I don't know, what he was really thinking at that time. So there are questions of political judgment. And then our question, given how he has flip-flopped over the years back and forth between the Democrats and Greens, let's just go over that. In 2000, he was campaigning for Bill Bradley in the Democratic primary. And then when Bill Bradley lost and Ralph Nader got in, he backed Nader. And then in 2004, when there was this backlash from left liberal forces against Nader and the Greens, Cornel West was out there publicly advocating against Nader and for pro-war Kerry. What was Kerry's first name? Well, pro-war Kerry. Kerry was saying he could fight the war in Iraq better than George Bush. And then, 2016, he was for Bernie. So he lost in the primary, then he was for Jill Stein. But in 2020, he was for Biden and against us in the Green Party. So I wonder, when the pressure comes and his peers who are, You know, he's never been part of an organization that organized people, a party, a union, a community organization. He's been an academic. He's well-known, a star. But he's joined letterhead coalitions. You know, they put the names of the people that support the coalition, you know, on the left, you know, left-hand side of these, sometimes the right, but usually the left of these appeals, mostly single issue stuff. But he played that role with DSA when Michael Harrington ran it, and it was definitely committed to the Democratic Party. So what's he going to do when, you know, his peers, the mass media, everybody's vilifying him for spoiling the election, you know, to elect Trump or DeSantis or whoever the Republican is? You know, will he stay in it? So I have that question. And then, you know, who's managing his campaign? It looks like Chris Hedges. I heard from somebody who might know, I won't reveal the source, but, you know, Medea Benjamin might be involved, which again is a surprise. She was one of the people saying vote for Biden last time instead of the green ticket. And the transparency. I mean, right now the money's going to the People's Party from looking at his website. So, you know, there's questions there. And then on his policy platform, what he says about democracy was really disappointing. He doesn't advocate for restoring the Voting Rights Act and putting in election protection provisions in the law to preempt what the Republicans are doing to suppress the vote and steal elections in the states they control. I mean, he should be beating up the Democratic Party on that. Instead, what he talks about is term limits for Congress, which is a conservative bromide instead of the game-changing reform of proportional representation, which the Greens advocate. And then he calls for hand-counted paper ballots, which are less accurate than machine-counted paper ballots. And it's another nostrum coming from the conspiracist election denier right. So I don't know if he got those from Nick Brown or the People's Party, but, you know, that's disappointing. And then, of course, I'm concerned about his position on Ukraine. What he's been saying is not consistently anti-imperialist in solidarity with Ukraine and their fight for independence and survival. He kind of supports this passive-aggressive pacifism that you're getting from Code Pink, which is demanding that U.S. imperialists impose a ceasefire and settlement negotiated over the heads of Ukrainians with the Russian imperialists, a land for peace deal that carves up Ukraine between Western and Russian spheres of influence. I don't think he's talked to the left in Ukraine, because they would tell him, you know, we got a say in this too. And this neutrality between the Russian aggressors and Ukrainian self-defense is just morally bankrupt complicity in Russian war crimes. And for a Christian preacher and a moral philosopher, what he's got his PhD in, that's not a good look. Now, I will grant him that he does condemn Putin's invasion of Ukraine. He calls Putin a gangster, Russian empire. That's all good. But are you going to support the people resisting that, or are you going to call for a compromise? I don't think he called for a compromise between Palestinians and Israelis on the land that Israelis are taking from the Palestinians. A land for peace deal there, that would not be just, nor would it be just in Ukraine. So I'm going to watch and see what he does on those policies. And I could say more, but I'll stop there. I'm sure it'll come up again in this discussion. I just saw somebody say, no, paper ballots are better. Yes, paper ballots, but you count them with a machine, run through the machine. That's been shown, documented many times, to be more accurate than hand counting all those paper ballots. So yes, paper ballots, verifiable paper trail. We want that. But to substitute machine counting for hand counting is opens up the door to a lot of problems. Amy Osak, we run west. But in the ninth, 10th hour, he suddenly demands that we throw votes to Biden. Question side, what then? I can't help but be skeptical, though he has had some great things to say. Yeah, Amy, that's what I was trying to say. I think I'm worried about that. And there's another side of him. You know, he always talks about, you know, prophecy or being the prophetic preacher. And, you know, maybe this time he's decided that no matter how much crap he gets for, you know, running against the Democrats and, quote unquote, spoiling the election, he wants to be the prophet and he will stick with it. But time will tell. I think it's a concern we need to consider. Frankie Lee, Howie, can we trust Cornel West will be running only with the Green Party and not in any way beholden to the donation grifter, Nick Brana? Well, I think, you know, this is a trust and verify situation. We don't know yet. He has said that he still wants the People's Party endorsement. He knows to get on a ballot, he's got to go with the Green Party. And he talks about vaguely other organizations or parties that might get behind a campaign. I don't know who he has in mind. I got the Socialist Party last time. I didn't get any of the state progressive third parties for a variety of reasons and found that most of them are really not much. They do have a ballot line in some states, but there's not much there. So in terms of on the ground support, there wasn't much to be had, although it would have been nice to be on the ballot or endorsed on the ballot by more than one party. Well, in those fusion states, like South Carolina would have been on two ballot lines. In Oregon, it would have been, green, progressive underneath, our names, Howie Hawkins and Angela Walker, on the ballot. That's called aggregated fusion. And then South Carolina has disaggregated fusion. And in California, in about half the states, according to Richard Winger of Ballot Access News, you can run fusion in presidential campaigns, even though you can't in others. Right now, it's the Green Party that's got the ballot lines, and a few other parties have ballot lines, but there's not much there. Violet at Content Boutique. RCV is going to make all the difference for the ability of Green and other third parties to make any difference. Yes, RCV, particularly proportional RCV for legislative bodies. If it's just RCV from single member districts, we'll win a few races, but mainly one of the two major parties is going to win them. Just given the that, you know, more people vote for the two major parties at this point. But at least we can run without being called spoilers. And I see in the chat, Steve Welser says, as of the last couple of days, a Green is now his treasurer, and a Green is now in charge of his campaign website. If you could share who those people are, we'd love to know. And Steve, did you ever get the book from Nader's people that you're supposed to get? I've been talking to them. I haven't got confirmation from them. If you give me confirmation, I could cross that off my list, or if not, get back at them to get you that book. At War with Dust. Never got the book. I'm sorry to hear that. Okay, that adds another thing to my to-do list on Monday. So there was another question there. At War with Dust. Why hasn't there been a red-green alliance between the Communist Party and the Green Party in the United States? The splintering of left-wing third parties seems to be short-sighted and demobilizing. The Communist Party has been in the Democratic Party really since 1936, except for 1948. Even when they ran their own candidates like Gus Hall and Angela Davis, they were really telling people to vote for the Democrats. So there's a fundamental difference there. In practice, the so-called Communist Party is really kind of a liberal democratic force. I think, the red-green politics are being exemplified now in the Green Party. We have determined that we're an eco-socialist party. We have an eco-socialist Green New Deal plank that was adopted in October. So I think those politics are there in the Green Party. The question is, most of the independent left, the socialist left in this country, if they're not, you know, in formations like the Communists or the DSA that orient to the Democratic Party, they're unattached, but they're not coming into the Green Party. They're kind of standing aloof. And I think the Green Party is where they belong. So it's not so much the organizations. It's really up to us in the Green Party to talk to those people in our communities and bring them in. They're just not going to, most of them, just walk in the door because they read the platform on the website or something. Most people get involved in groups that they've had personal contact with and see are real and have a personal relationship with. That's what organizing is about. And I think that's how we can build, you know, red, green or eco-socialist politics. And but it's got to be organizing, you know, not just making statements. You know, there used to be a critique of resolutionary socialism instead of revolutionary socialism. A lot of these little groups and some people who are unattached, they're big on making statements, and now we got the internet and they put it online, but that doesn't bring in as many people as if you're going around your community working on an issue campaign or an electoral campaign and talking to people and building relationships and giving them a way to get involved in an ongoing way with the local party. Beloved community, Cornel West has called for a united front. That seems similar to your efforts to unite Greens and socialists. I agree. I mean, a united front, it's really what are the, you know, common demands of that united front. And I think, you know, most of the things Cornel says, I would agree with. I'd like to see him, and it's early, so, you know, this may be premature criticism, but I'd like to see more on more developed presentation of climate action, the eco-socialist Green New Deal. I've seen several of his interviews. He's very good at, you know, invoking various names of people, prominent people over the years, and analyzing the problem. But when it comes to what's the policy, he doesn't seem to get there by the end of the question. So I think that's something, you know, we will see as this develops, you know, where he comes out on these policies. But in terms of what's on his website, you know, I didn't disagree with anything but the things I mentioned. Except for Ukraine, I forget what he said. He's going to end the war in Ukraine or something, but I'm going on what he said in other formats about Ukraine. But the democracy thing, I think we can move him on that. That should be that shouldn't be hard. I'm not really that worried about it. Emoji. I've noticed disaffected leftists seem more interested in the Green Party, but grassroots organizing is the key. Exactly right. And I'm looking at your emoji. It almost looks like Korean. I wonder what it says. But it's exactly right. You know, now that COVID's, well, it's not really over, but now that we're out and about and talking to people, we need to be, have an organized grassroots organizing program of, you know, canvassing people in their homes, at work, wherever you can meet them. And, you know, talking to people about the issues. As I talked about this, it's more important to listen to people than to preach at them. Most people get involved in politics or movements, it's a gut thing. You know, they want to do, are these people, you know, they care about me? Are they fighting for my interests? And can I, you know, relate to them? And that's more, and listening, you know, few politicians actually go out and talk to many people. You know, they do press conferences, they do their little staged events with the people behind them, all handpicked. It's not just grassroots people. So they observe the politicians on TV and maybe run across them close to an election, shaking hands somewhere. But they don't have a relationship with the candidate or the party or, you know, the candidate's campaign. And so that's the kind of thing we need to be doing a lot more of, you know, getting out and talking to people. And Of course, you don't hide your program. What you listen, people just appreciate the opportunity to let off, you know, tell, you know, somebody who's running for office or a political party, you know, what their issues are, what their problems are, what's bugging them, what they want solved. And I've found in campaigns that there's, you know, I go into a campaign with, you know, some issues in mind I want to raise. But when I, as I go out and start talking to people, I always find there's at least one issue that I really wasn't that aware of. You know, for example, when I ran in 2014 for governor of New York, I was somewhat aware of the disaffection with the high stakes testing. Maybe this was 2010. And, you know, it had been an issue since Bush's law to be passed. What's it called? Race to the Top or Nobody Left Behind, something like that. But it mandated a lot of testing. And people were disgusted because their kids were spending too much time in test prep, took away from other parts of schooling. It was stressful. And the tests really just are good for, you know, diagnosing what you haven't learned yet, but they're not good for, you know, being gatekeepers to, you know, what schools people can get in to and that kind of thing. So there's a real backlash against that. And it was a central issue in that campaign. And one of the Republicans actually put up a ballot line called, it was a no testing ballot line. I forget the name right now. Yeah, I think I'm talking about 2010. So anyway, that's an example where, you know, I had my issues, but the people had theirs, and you've got to be responsive. Z Manny, hi. Is there any way to address media behavior regarding the elections to push some climate of accountability regarding how the media cover campaigns, what candidates or issues they anoint as viable? Oh, man. Well, you know, we need a media policy. We need to have more media sources, get rid of the oligopolies, you know, something like 5 or 6 media monopolies control almost all the broadcast media and the major newspapers. And, you know, the social media has opened that up a little bit, but they're the ones that decide what issues to cover and what issues not to cover. So one way to raise that is to, you know, raise the issue on the streets so they can't ignore it. Mass movements, like, you know, if it had been after George Floyd was murdered, you know, just a demonstration or even, you know, unrest in Minneapolis for a few days, it wouldn't have become a major issue that it became because that movement spread across the country and the media could not ignore it. That's how we can get issues raised. Social movements can do that. And then, you know, I think one of the media reforms we need is with local newspapers and other newspapers really having a hard time, given that the advertising has moved to social media platforms like Facebook and so forth. We should have publicly funded newspapers, independent of the government, by having the boards picked by a sortition, like we pick juries. And you get a random sample of the community that can set the policies in terms of, you know, editorial policy and issues that are chosen. And then the reporters and editors and so forth can, you know, act independently of the corporate interests that are profit oriented. And I think we need a lot more of that kind of support for media. And I believe in New Jersey, they've got some kind of pilot program on that. I can't remember the details, but it sounded decent to me, at least a good start. And that's the kind of thing that we need to expand. So there's, you know, more issues are covered. And I mean, like on cable news, there's 1 or 2 issues of the day and they beat it to death. You know, they'll give you the news, which takes a few seconds, and then they bring on 3 or 4 talking heads and they talk it to death. And if you think about what you learned from the talking heads, it's usually not much more than what the news was. So, you know, I contrast, you know, MSNBC, CNN and Fox News, the 3 major cable outlets, with BBC. BBC covers stories all over the world. So even their 30-minute news segment is kind of short, but you get around the world and you get news that if you listen to CNN or MSNBC or Fox, you'll never get. So that's another thing. We need a less insular media because there's a lot going on in the world that affects us. And Americans are pretty ignorant about what's going on around the world. Amy Sachs, at Z-Manny, you'd hope. So many of these supposedly progressive sites are vicious and hostile toward every green they encounter. Even Goodman froze us out in the last election. Yeah, I was talking to Angela. You know, we noticed that as soon as Cornell announced, he's on Democracy Now. And she didn't give us a second of time throughout the 2020 campaign. And she's had me on a couple of times over the years. Although I have to say, you know, the first time I got on was I was running against Hillary Clinton for the U.S. Senate. And I got on because she wouldn't debate me. And a brother in Seattle, Aaron Dixon, who was formed the Seattle Black Panther Party, is running as the Green candidate for Senate there. He had tried to barge into a debate saying, I'm a candidate, I want to debate. And he got arrested. So she had us on. Then she kept me on and brought in a reporter from the Philadelphia Inquirer to ask me about a candidate in Pennsylvania that got money from a right winger for his petition drive. And I said, well, I wouldn't have taken that money. But then I flipped the script on her and told her about what was happening in Pennsylvania. This candidate and Ralph Nader were being fined tens of thousands of dollars in a law that was flipped by these hack judges, Democrats. The law said if you file a frivolous protest to a petition, a challenge to a petition, you could be fined. And they flipped that around and said, if you have frivolous signatures on your petition, you can be fined. Now, if you're doing tens of thousands of signatures to get on a ballot, some idiot's going to write Mickey Mouse and the petitioner may not notice it. So in tens of thousands of signatures, you may have a few Donald Ducks and Mickey Mouses. Should you be fined tens of thousands of dollars? I mean, when that was in effect, it basically meant if you're a Green and you want to run for office, you'd have to mortgage your house to pay off the fines if you had a house. So that's a real deterrent for Greens even running. Eventually, Nader and the other guy whose name I'm blanking on got those fines relieved, but it took like 10 years. So, you know, Democracy Now! Has not been friendly to independent left politics. And I think, you know, one thing to watch will be how does Goodman handle Cornel West if he stays in and is seen as the spoiler? Is she going to be one of those that either freezes him out or puts the screws to him like the rest of the media? Z-Manny, we know the media is preparing now to undermine any non-duopoly campaigns. What preparations now to be ready to counter the tactics they will bring? Well, we need to keep voicing our argument that if you want, I mean, this is one of the things I was saying during the campaign. If you want Medicare for all, don't vote for Biden. He's against it. Don't vote for the Republican. He's against it. Vote for the Green candidate. If you want a Green New Deal to deal with the climate change, vote for the Green candidate. Biden is against it. The Republican is against it. And you can go on down all our issues. And if you don't vote for what you want, you're never going to get it. Now, we may not win the election, but with what votes we get, we'll have some leverage. And I've told this example many times on this podcast, but I'll say it again. When I got 5% against Andrew Cuomo running for governor in 2014, Cuomo was shocked. He had wanted to run up the vote, get more than he ever got, more than he got in 2010 when he ran the first time, more than his father ever got. He wanted to get ready to run for president. And he got less votes because we got 5% of the vote. And he had to look at what we were campaigning on. And what he did right after the election in the next legislative session was adopt some policies that we advocated and he either opposed or was hedging on. So we got a ban on fracking. We got a $15 minimum wage. We got paid family leave. So with just 5% of the vote, we had some leverage. And that's what the Democrats in particular, we got a lot of leverage over them if we can get you know, even a few percent of the vote in a close election, because they know that our platform is more popular with the masses of people than theirs is. You know, the Democrats, Biden's running to the right. Fiscal austerity, this debt ceiling deal he did with McCarthy, you know, that's not real popular with people. And so, you know, he's not delivering on, you know, people's material needs or economic needs, not delivering on social questions like the Voting Rights Act. You know, all that would have taken was 51 votes in the Senate to change the rules, get rid of the filibuster, and pass the Voting Rights Act, the Election Protection Bill, the codifying of Roe v. Wade, the Equality Act, and so many other things that are, you know, they're not radical in the sense of changing the system, but they are things that we want and are good for the people. But the Democrats couldn't deliver because they really didn't want to take on the filibuster. And they made H.R. 1, that was their top priority, the, you know, Electoral Reform Act, which had a lot of measures, but included improvements and restoration of parts of the Voting Rights Act, and in its later versions, election protection to preempt what the Republicans were doing in the states they control. And the Democrats didn't succeed. So we need just to pound away on that message. And we're not going to get the mass media to be friendly. That's why grassroots organizing is so important. Because then you build relationships, you can talk to people about these issues. Social media is open to us. And, you know, I think Cornell has like a million followers on Twitter. You know, that's a good start. Hell of a lot more than I have. I don't know what my number is, but it's not that. So that's what we got to do. We just got to keep speaking out. And I know sometimes people get discouraged, but letters to the editor, you know, especially local papers, they're always looking for letters to the editor. You can't say much, but you can say something. And so that's all I can say. Just keep speaking up in every format available to you. And another thing is, you know, you can raise these issues when, you know, Ralph Nader's always talking about this. You know, the members of Congress have a 3-day work week and they're on vacation after year. Right now in July, well, they're coming up on July 4th, recess, and then they're going to take all of August off. They're going to be home. They're going to have some events, and we can show up at them. And those are forums in which we can raise our positions. And sometimes the media cover those, and they'll get broadcast there. You can always leaflet those meetings. And that's just one example of ways we can take advantage of gatherings of people to get our message out. So, you know, the main thing is just keep working hard, plugging away. Pace yourself, don't burn out, but keep plugging away. Just regular, if you're out there consistently and people see you, that has an impression. I just know in the work I do, I'm always running into people who I don't know, but they know me because they know I've been out there. And a lot of those people, you know, appreciate that and encourage me to keep doing it. See, Manny, as you say, a big question here is the various meanings of a third party campaign can have. See how vigorously they try to steer our attention away from that. This 5% threshold, for instance. Yeah. Everybody talks about a 5% threshold without knowing what it means. Some people say then you get status as a national party. What it means is that you qualify for public funding for the party's next presidential campaign. And it's prorated between 5% and 25%. The two major parties qualify for a flat out grant. And I can't remember the amounts now, but it's millions of dollars for the major parties and tens of millions of dollars. And if we got 5%, we get a few million dollars anyway, or several million dollars. So that's what that means. That's all it means. It doesn't mean we get any formal status or ballot status or anything like that. It's just to qualify for that public funding, which in H.R. 1, which I just mentioned, the Democrats wanted to scrap. No, what they did first in the first version of the bill, they made it hard. No, that was the matching funds. The public funding they wanted to scrap totally. They were making the matching funds, which is a different program. You have to get $5,000 in 20 state raised from qualified contributions of $200 or less. And then you that money is matched by the Federal Election Commission. So in the first round of the HR1, it was, they raised that to, I think it was 25,000 in 20 states, five times more, which would be probably beyond the reach of most green presidential campaigns. And then in the latest version of that bill, they just totally scrapped the matching funds program for presidential elections. They were adding it, a matching funds program for congressional races, and a voucher program is experimental, I believe. In any case, the 5% is about public funding in the next presidential round. And I'm just trying to grapple with your whole question. Yeah, we shouldn't get stuck on 5%. We should really be stuck on getting our message out, and that, you know, the more votes we get, the more leverage we'll have pushing for our programs going forward. Violated content boutique. Why is Jill in trouble for that public funding cash? They're still on her case. Yeah, she got money from the FEC that I guess on their second thought said she wasn't qualified for, because see, when you file for matching funds, there's a deadline when those matching funds count. And she used a deadline similar to the one she used in 2012, which was the last day she filed a petition. In 2012, however, the Democrats had their convention on Labor Day weekend, which was late. In 2016, they had it in late July or early August, which is the deadline. The deadline in the rules is the last day, or the day when the last major party nominates. So Jill kept collecting money after that date, assuming that that last petition she filed would be the deadline, because it's about getting on the ballot. The matching funds is for helping you run your primary campaign. Reasonable conclusion, but FEC has not been consistent over the years on that, and they did not give her a quick response when she filed the matching funds application and filed that as her deadline date. And they gave her the money. And then they decided, oops, we shouldn't have given her that money. She has to give it back. But she'd already spent it. So now she's in a bind. If she doesn't get favorable ruling in the court, she's on the hook for, I think, $175,000. Her campaign doesn't have it, but she's personally responsible. And that's a shame. That's the kind of thing that discourages people from running for office. I just want to report that our campaign in 2020, we got no fines from the FEC, and we have terminated the account. So we got through it without any fines. It's done. The only problem is we didn't get the matching funds we actually qualified for, because they asked for further documentation, more documentation than I know Jill Stein or previous Greens had had to file. We provided that, but we provided it after a deadline that they gave to us in a five-page lawyer's letter buried on page 3. And we didn't see that date. And we talked to lawyers, and they said, there's no rule about this. It's arbitrary, but they gave you that date and you missed it. You'd have a tough time in court. So we decided we didn't have the money to go to court anyway. So unfortunately, we didn't get that money. And, you know, unfortunately, that was the people that worked on my campaign were really glorified volunteers. They got modest stipends every month. But the promise was if we got the matching funds, we topped those stipends off. And unfortunately, we weren't able to. So I just really appreciate the fact that all those people that worked on our campaign as glorified volunteers did so. And I just thank them again. So that's, you know, that's Jill's dilemma. Thoughts on Trump being indicted on the document charges? Well, finally. I mean, this is pretty obvious. And I know I'm not a lawyer. I know you got to get all your ducks in a row so you can, you know, bring it to trial and get a conviction. It's just that Trump's been a crook his whole life. You know, going back to the racial discrimination they were doing in the Trump apartments in Brooklyn and the Bronx and Queens, I guess, where they settled out of court. And, you know, so Trump says he never was convicted on that. But, you know, the money laundering, I think Trump's had it really easy. I think if you read the reporting, he's been money laundering for the Russians, the Saudis, even the Iranians with these, you know, Trump Towers. People buy these condos and then they flip them and they get cash that's clean on the other side. And he's supposed to do due diligence. He hasn't. And Rod Rosenstein told Mueller not to follow the money. That's not part of his investigation, and Mueller, the Boy Scout that he is, followed those instructions. So I think there's a whole lot more that Trump's been doing that just hasn't come to light. He's got the bank fraud, insurance fraud, tax fraud case in New York. He's got the election fraud case in Georgia. And what's the other big one? Oh, the insurrection. So there's more coming down the pike, and I guess I think finally. And, you know, if he's convicted on what just this charge, he should go to prison for the rest of his life. Looking at the chart, the sentences, other people that have taken documents in less blatant way than he has, the kind of sentences they've received. So Trump may finally have, you know, met his match in this prosecutor. I think Garland took too long, but at least we're getting somewhere now. Although these cases take years to resolve. So, you know, Trump will run to raise money with the hope of getting elected and pardoning himself. So if Trump is the candidate, you know, Cornel West, if he's the candidate, going to have to deal with what I dealt with. You know, most people are going to want to just keep Trump out. It's going to be tough for the Greens. That the Republican Party is not just a conservative party now. It's an extremist authoritarian party. And most of the center-left voters, you know, don't want to risk the Republicans being in charge of the presidency. So it's very tough for us. That's why ranked choice voting and proportional representation should be central to our program. It's also the best defense against the spoiler charge. Well, we're against spoiling, too. We have an answer to that. Ranked choice voting and proportional representation in legislative bodies. Violet at Content Boutique. Do you think we'll ever see a trial for Trump's Georgia offenses? That seems like the most important one, or at least one of the most important ones. Yeah, I think the insurrection charges are also up there. I think we'll see a trial. I think we'll see an indictment. And I think we'll see a trial. I mean, Trump is not the kind of guy that'll settle. And in this case, what does he settle? He admits he tried to steal the election and what, pay a big fine or do a shorter sentence? I don't know where that will end up. But I think we'll see a trial because, you know, Trump's history is to, you know, take it to trial, not admit wrong, unless he can get a good, you know, deal with the prosecutors. But I hope it goes to trial. I guess that's what I'll say. Beloved community, glad you had a productive trip and returned safely. Your conversations with those Aussie Greens was great. Yeah, I've been trying to get them. I'm going to get some more on because they have been doing the kind of grassroots organizing, you know, canvassing the people, keeping lists, talking to them, you know, in a recurring way. When you make a contact, it's important that you stay in communication with them. If you don't, then they think, well, you didn't really care. Even if you just send them short messages about what you're doing or occasionally asking them what do they think about an issue. You know, by now email is much cheaper than regular mail. So there's no excuse for us not to do that. And the Aussie Greens have been doing that. And that's why even with single member district ranked choice voting for their house, they've gone from 1 to 4 out of 151 seats, which is just about as hard to do as to win those elections by plurality voting. And of course, in the Senate in Australia, it's proportional ranked choice voting from multi-member districts. So the Greens are in Australia are a 10 to 12% party in the last three elections. And in the Senate, they've always had a proportionate number of senators. But in the House, they just had this one until the last election where they added three more. So I think there's more that we can learn from the Australian Greens. And now I've got some direct contact, so it should be easier to get some people on. Okay, that's the hour. Next week, I don't have a guest planned, although I'm working on some guests. And one of them, I think, was mentioned maybe on Twitter that one guy I want to get on is Frank Habineza, who is the presidential candidate of the Democratic Green Party of Rwanda. He's a member of parliament. He's a brave man because there's been violence against members of his party and him. So he's sticking his neck out to run for president. But he's running against Paul Kagame, who is problematic in terms of domestic repression and foreign adventures in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So, and then there are ecological issues. So he's one person. Svetlana Romanko, who's an environmentalist in Ukraine, has put together a group. They're doing material aid now. She was the contact for 350.org before the war started. And she has a lot to say about ecological reconstruction, post-war reconstruction. And there's a brother in Puerto Rico who was elected to the Senate from the Citizens Victory Movement, a third party, a lot like the Greens. So I'm going to be lining them up in the next few weeks. I'm leaving somebody out that I just talked to. I can't remember. I'm suffering from jet lag. So by next week, I should be back to normal. So anyway, thanks for being here today. And we'll continue the conversation next week.